No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions or comments to BBSRADIOPR. Tonight we have a very exciting guest, but first we're going to welcome back our my co-host Maria Sanchez, who's just come back from an exciting adventure in Chicago that we're going to talk about a little bit, and then we'll have a presidential candidate, Admiral Joe Sestak, join us in a few minutes. Maria, how are you?
Michael, happy Sunday and good afternoon and evening to you, and hello to our listeners, who we are forever grateful for. And I had a beautiful opportunity to promote our program and BBS Radio yesterday. I was in attendance, as you mentioned, at the American Psychological Association's 127th annual convention. It's the largest gathering of psychologists in the world every year. There were 11,000 of us in attendance. And wow, talk about shrinking the room.
Wow.
So my presentation yesterday was on giving psychology away, how to use media to help yourself get heard. And there was such enthusiasm and interest and questions that when we concluded, some folks asked me to stay if I could answer their questions more individually. So it was really thrilling to see how psychologists are wanting to help exploit and get the word out or create their niche or promote what it is that they do or whatever, however you want to work it. So it was great to be able to help that. And having been a talk radio host for 25 years and the privilege to work with you now for almost 3 years now, and then getting my master's in clinical psychology, and this week I get my master's in media psychology, and then next month I become a doctoral candidate in media psychology, I think it's a really nice balance between media and psychology with my personal real-life experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. And you would think, I mean, I don't know, but you would think that there'd be so much use for social media with all the depression and everything we have in our society. I mean, could connections to social media and the internet and this vast network intervene in things like teen suicide and, you know, so many of the problems that we have? I would just think there's just amazing potential there, and we've just scratched the surface.
And really good observation, because one, yes, and two, that's a lot of what I've been studying. And then three, there's telehealth, which now offers counseling via the internet, either Skype, audio, or video, with a certified therapist. And then there's also therapy that's being offered with, what would you call them, like emoticons, or when somebody takes an avatar. And they say that that is as effective as an interaction with a human being, because the client feels less judged and more freedom to share some intimate things that they might be afraid that there would be judgment by from a real human being.
Yeah, and I would think things like peer group counseling, you know, things like that would be, you know, there'd be so much use for the internet and social media in areas like that. It just seems to me that it could be a really, really great tool. And again, you just amaze me that you're on the cutting edge of all this and that you're going to get your PhD. I mean, we won't even know how to deal with you. We'll have to call you Dr. Maria, and, you know, we're going to have to work that out. But, yeah, that's just amazing.
It's been a real honor because, as you mentioned, technology has come so far. There's also usages with augmented reality, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, immersive reality. They're finding people who suffer from PTSD are being able to get some relief by putting on a helmet and going through augmented and virtual reality scenarios. And it's helping to decompress and remove the stigma and that which they suffered from. And I mean, you're right. It's cutting edge.
And that doesn't surprise me at all. And it really goes back to the first, one of the first treatments for a battle fatigue was that in ancient Rome, they used to set people with battle fatigue in front of big aquariums and let them watch fish because it was so soothing. And that was one of the first treatments I read somewhere for a psychological disorder.
I never heard that, and it makes a lot of sense, because think about how tranquil and how you could get lost in the moment and, you know, remove yourself from your fear, your anxiety, your depression, what have you. So, yeah, now they're doing it with technology.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, everything old is new again, right, at some point. Well, my exciting news for the week is
What's that?
I've been invited to speak at an international economic conference, the India Resilience Summit of 2019, to be held at the end of the month in the largest city in southern India. So they've invited me to come over and give a keynote speech on one of the days, and that's just really exciting. It's people heard me at the Horace's conference in Portugal in the spring, and some of them from the IETO, the Indian Economic Trade Organization, have invited me to come speak. So I think I'm doing everything to. It's very short notice, 3 weeks, but we're working out the arrangements right now, and it looks like I'm going to go, and I just can't wait.
So tell me more, what will your topic be? How long do you get to speak? Will you be on a panel? And what's the point of this gathering?
Well, there's 300 delegates from all over the world that are going to attend the conference. Mm. And the idea behind the conference is to hook, very much like the Horses Conference, to connect people in government and economics and cultural relations from around the world together so they can start to talk about ways to interact. So the main theme of my speech will be, you know, our role in globalization, our role in America in the whole globalization strategy that people are trying to develop to bring the world closer together. And again, you know, I think a lot of what I will talk about is technology. I really think that the technological revolution that we're going through now is going to, you know, everything else that's gone on in terms of the history of mankind is going to pale in comparison to this. This is going to be bigger than what we're seeing now. Is going to be bigger than the industrial revolution in affecting, I believe, the way the world interacts with each other. We're getting closer every day. You know, the world is getting smaller every day. As I said on the show a few weeks ago, I witnessed somebody in a hut in Africa performing an operation. This was on a news program, and they were connected to surgeons who had done this unusual operation many times at Johns Hopkins University. So, mm-hmm. you know, the fact that we can connect people from all around the world now is I really think, going to change everything.
Eventually. Well, that's the virtual reality part.
Yeah.
We studied those things too. And in other words, you don't have to be in the room anymore. You can right. diagnose, and you can also advise, and you can also fix, like, technology or cars or air conditioners or plumbing, and have your technician be on the ground and you be somewhere else in the world.
And you can do commerce, you know, that's just changing dramatically the way we do commerce. And, you know, you look at things like Bitcoin, right? We had the, mm-hmm. we had the Bitcoin expert on. You know, it's just, I mean, I don't think that 100 years from now, people are even going to recognize the way we do business today and, you know, the way the world is today. And things like medicine are just, you know, those things are going to explode.
So how long are you going to be there, and how are you getting there? Having been to Delhi myself, I'm curious what your journey looks like from the East Coast.
Well, you and I need to talk if you've been to Delhi, because I looked at, you know, just the flights are like 21 hours.
Yes.
And that's by far the longest time I've ever been on a plane. So I'm gonna get there. I'm only going to be there for a couple of days, but I'm going to get there. I'm going to get there a day early, because nobody wants to hear me give a speech after I've been on a plane for 22 hours.
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah, I would not be comprehensible. But the city that's hosting the event is Hyderabad, I believe is the way you pronounce it. And it's the largest city in southern India. It's a long way from Delhi, but it's got a population of 9 million people, and it's the capital of that particular region of the country. So it's going to take a while to get there.
Michael, my experience was, I went from Delhi to Bareilly, which was north. It took us 8 hours to go 125 miles.
Wow.
Because you have not only other transportation on the road with you, buses and tuk-tuks and scooters and mopeds, you also have wildlife.
Well, they're telling me it's 30 minutes from the airport, so we'll keep our fingers crossed and see, you know, what that means. You know, in Washington, everything is 30 minutes from Washington. You know, you talk to people that live 2 hours outside the city, and they say, oh, it only takes me 30 minutes to get to work. Yeah, if you drive 85 miles an hour at midnight. Maybe.
If you're being helicoptered in.
Right, right. So if the president gets there in 30 minutes, exactly. Yeah. Well, we're about to, I hope, hook up with our guest tonight, who is Admiral Joe Sestak. He's running for president. We'll wait to get him on to give you all the details, but he's an amazing individual. He's a former 3-star admiral. He was in the Navy for 31 years. He's the highest ranking military officer ever elected to Congress. He represented the Pennsylvania 7th Congressional District for 2 terms. He was born in Delaware, attended the U.S. Navy Academy, received his Ph.D. in economics and government from Harvard University. He was deployed in the Pacific and the Atlantic. He served as the Politico-Military Assessment Division Joint Chiefs of Staff, Director for Defense Policy on the White House National Security Council. When he was in command, he was deployed in the Persian Gulf and Mediterranean, where he was also the director of the Navy Strategic Anti-Terrorism Unit, Deep Blue, and served the War Command in the Persian Gulf as commander of the Aircraft Carrier Battle Group. As Deputy Chief of Naval Operations, he was in charge of a $350 billion budget. He proposed to change the Navy from 375 ships to 260 with a cyberspace focus. We can't wait to talk to him.
And Admiral, he's here now.
Yes, Admiral, thank you so much for being on the show. I would go over the rest of your resume, but we wouldn't have any time left to speak. You are so accomplished. And let me start by saying what I've been trained to say as a little boy to any veteran I ever met since I was a little boy, and that is, thank you for your service.
And sir,
your service has just been exceptional, not only as a military person, but also in serving in Congress. So welcome to our show, and thanks for being on.
Senator, thank you very much. And Maria, great to be on with you also, and I'm looking forward to this very much.
Thank you.
Now, let me ask you, Admiral, when we start, are you in Iowa these days?
I am. I've been here, I think, except for one or two days, about 47 days since I got here at the end of June, declared my candidacy. And I'm actually looking out the window as I just got back from shaking hands in a parade of an Econo Lodge, which we got a great deal for, about $39 a night, because they're going through construction. So this is home away from home.
Wow.
Well, yeah, it's a $39 room at the Econo Lodge is a long way from being a three-star admiral, huh?
You know, though, we've the owner of the place has had me over to his Hindu temple, and the Hispanic members of the construction crew are having me over to talk to about 200 of the construction workers. So it has its payback in people to people touching.
Yeah. Talking about grassroots, huh?
Yeah, and you know, I was amazed. The Des Moines Register.
Maria, it's cutting out. I don't know why.
You. It said you impress with your experience, your smarts, and your discipline,
Maria?
And they called you fearless. So you really seem like an incredible candidate to me.
I was mentioning that with your experience now with the folks that are staying or providing your stay at the Econo Lodge, that you're a true grassroots campaign from the ground up. And what does that feel like? Did you think that it was actually going to be able to be that intimate?
Yes, actually, I knew it was going to have to be. I knew that this was going to be not unlike Jimmy Carter did when he ran, where he was living in houses. But since I didn't know people here, and he knew a few from his approach here, I said to my staff, it's not only going to be grassroots, we're going to have to be grass seeds. And so we've really burrowed in. In fact, on our Twitter account, you could see we just tweeted four pictures of where press had come out of the Iowa State Fair, and they all individually tweeted over about 4 hours pictures of our brochures under their windshield. In fact, another person a couple days ago tweeted an Enterprise lot of their car rental where its wiper blades were pointing up, and it said, "The Enterprise does this in case Joe Sestak comes by and wants to wants to brochure him again." I have shaken over 25,000 hands, and literally in parades mainly, because it's the best door to door you can do. My staff goes down ahead of me, and initially I didn't have any staff here. Supporters, volunteers. So I went to a veterans homeless shelter and paid them above minimum wage. And some of them are still working full-time for me now, and they pass out the brochure ahead of me, and I run back and forth in the hot sun and shake everybody's hand, and I say, "Hey, that's me, a retired Navy admiral. Take me home tonight, and look at that brochure. I just got in this race, and I'd appreciate it very much." And I'll tell you this, Senator, just like you said, one out of four in Iowa will say to me, "Thanks for your service." Yeah. Whoever, I did not know about Iowa niceness, but boy, have I learned about it. So it's been a good experience. I'll be honest with you.
Well, there, I've got to tell you, Admiral, I was at the Iowa caucuses in 2016, the last Iowa caucuses, and they're among the nicest people I ever met. I mean, everybody, they just act in Iowa, they just, at the caucuses anyway, they act like they've invited you into their home, you know, that you're a guest. And I really have never been treated politically the way I was treated at the Iowa caucuses. And you know, if there's a tie in the caucus, they flip a coin, or they cut a deck of cards to decide who the winner is. That would never happen in Washington, D.C. There would be lawyers lined up on both sides. But yeah, it's absolutely an amazing place.
I wonder, Mike, having had that respect that you have as an officer, especially as a 3-star admiral, because you know this too well, Michael, how dirty politics can get.
Yep.
How humbling or terrifying must that be that you don't get afforded that respect that you should, especially for what he's done for our freedom, personally,
right.
Not just in name only.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, head of a term, the National Security Council director at the White House, head of the Strategic Anti-Terrorism Unit. I mean, he's done great things for our nation.
When I was doing my presentation yesterday, I deliberately chose not to use technology because some of the presentations that I went to, because the convention started on Thursday morning, when technology failed them in the room, they were lost. That, you know, they had their notes there, they had their prompts there, and then suddenly they're looking at us and it's almost like, oh boy, now what? So I wrote it down. I knew what I was speaking about, but I just read it 3 or 4 times, and then I spoke extemporaneously without notes, without referring to any technology, because if it goes wrong, it's pretty scary.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. You know, we had that happen when we gave our presentation at in Chicago. We couldn't the whole thing was on the internet. Okay. We couldn't connect. We're back. Admiral,
yes.
Senator.
With us.
Admiral, again, because of how distinguishedly you served our country and how we, every American, owes you every breath and every sacrifice and that of your family that you took to help preserve our freedom, how does it feel to be in a political process that's nasty and backbiting and brings out the worst in people?
You know, it's a great question by you.
Emailed
somebody who had actually said something about being in politics literally before, and I went back to her and I said, the reason I enjoy politics is in the Navy, I molded the youth of America for a common mission. The reason I enjoy politics is I learned that you got to see human nature most raw, except for war. Because I found that everybody has an interest. It could be a mom with an autistic child that isn't getting the right type of 504 plan. Or it can be, as what happened to me, where my party put in more money against my last Senate race from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee than they put in against Mitch McConnell. And so what you find is if you care about learning of human nature, and I do, I find it a fascinating study. And I think because of my military background, I don't find it depressing. I find it disappointing, and frankly, in both parties, in the way they go about exactly what you said. But, you know, it's human nature. And for me, at this stage of my life, the last 10 years, after my daughter, as you know, was saved from glioblastoma with a wonderful health care plan we had in the military. And that's the reason I'm in late, is my daughter's brain cancer came back last year.
Okay.
And I wasn't thinking of getting in. But as I sat with her, I decided to again to do this because I do believe we have to unite this country above anything else. That's the sole reason I'm really running. But I have to tell you, I actually like it because if I'm running through that parade today, and someone came up to me, I rolled over and I shook their hand. They didn't want to shake it at first. They were very polite. they said, no, I'm a Trump supporter. I'm for the wall. And I just kind of said, well, ma'am, I just want you to know I represent a 2-to-1 Republican district. And I got reelected without a penny being spent on a campaign ad. And while I do believe we have to protect our borders, I also believe we have to protect our security. And American women's birth rate since 1970 hasn't been enough to replenish those who pass away every year. And if it wasn't for immigration, we'd be in a population death spiral. And you know what? She just said, well, I just didn't know that, but thanks. I mean, it was like, how will she take this if I just talk to her about a fact that, oh, it's something? And I find that, and I'm going on a bit too long, Maria, but I find
that fascinating. It's fascinating.
I just find it fascinating about how these interests of people, you know, and do you give them another fact or something and see how they respond? And I know it sounds like I'm doing a case study on human nature, but that's why I enjoy it.
Well, and you know, you're just so right about this. And this, Admiral, in my humble opinion, I've been in Democratic politics for 40 years. This is one thing I don't think the Democratic Party has fully understood, that exactly what you just said, that I think one of the problems we've had is not reaching out to people and listening to them and trying to explain how we feel about things. I think one of our major problems is we talk down to people. You know, and so it's refreshing to hear a candidate who really gets it. And can we talk for a second? Just I don't want to belabor this point, but I found your situation in the Senate race in Pennsylvania so unusual that you won the primary and that you didn't get adequate support from the Democratic Party. For those people that don't know, Arlen Specter, who is a Republican, changed to a Democrat, and the Democratic Party supported him. Am I not right about this?
That is correct.
More than they supported you. And I just found that incredible.
And it was interesting. They had asked if I'd run for Senate twice, and I had not been interested because I ran for Congress for one reason. I owed my country, literally, for saving my daughter with a health care plan. And I ran on the one refrain that I'm a retired Navy admiral, run on national security that begins at home and health security. And the third time they asked, I said, okay, I think I'll go ahead and do this. But then Arlen Specter switched parties. And of course, my whole party from the president on down endorsed it readily. And I didn't. I never forgot. And I have six sisters, and I put out a video on this when I announced, saying, I think how he handled Anita Hill in those hearings on her sexual harassment charges against now Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was wrong. Now, today in the Me Too generation, no Democrat would have accepted it. But that's a problem, I think, with politicians that you brought up. Sometimes they're of the moment. And if it was not right now, why right not right back then? So I ran against them. I was 40 points down in my first rate at poll. But we eventually beat them, and the paucity of support from the party was there. But that's what accountability is. I'm running on accountability for oneself, to people above party, above any special interest. And I think that's what the country most wants. I tell the Democrats, that's our Hobson's choice. If you want to heal our soul and meet any of the defining challenges of our time, abroad or here at home, you'll only do it with United America. And look, whether it was John F. Kennedy or Ronald Reagan, it was a United America. We disagreed well. And in my mind, that's what we need today. You know, I did learn that it is in that incident with Arlen Specter that I tell people it's better to offend God than a politician, because at least God will give forgiveness. But you know what? That's what accountability is. And for me to stand next to Mr. Trump and to tell those Trump supporters, those that are now kind of looking, as a few of them I put up on my Twitter account the other day who have met with me, to say, look, it isn't about party. It is about you. I think that is the only way we're ever going to come together, and that's the only reason I'm really in.
Well, I think it's a great reason to be in, and I think that, you know, again, this has been part of our problem, is that instead of talking to Trump supporters, we spend our time vilifying them.
Or resisting them, right.
And we really should reach out to them and say, and find out why they're Trump supporters, and find out what we need to do as a party to reach them again. You know, it's amazing to me that a guy that's worth, who's a billionaire, convinced working class people in Detroit that he felt their pain, and the Democrats who have traditionally had people like that in their party have lost them, and we need to go find them again, and thank God you're doing that.
Admiral, may I ask you something? Because I come from a military family. My dad was in the Korean War, and I have a brother who was a captain in the Marine Corps, and I live in Port Hueneme, which is a naval base, and then, of course, San Diego to the south of me where my mom lives. Everybody that, in general, that I've known growing up and now know as an adult, if they're in the military, they tend to be Republicans.
Yeah.
How is it that you're not? Or why is it that you're not?
I can't tell you how many times in my nearly 2-to-1 Republican districts, I didn't have a Republican say to me, aren't you supposed to be with us?
Yeah.
And I remember I hand out brochures when I was running for Congress at a train station. And I'd be there from 6 until 8. And I remember the third person I handed a brochure to. I said, hey, I'm a retired Navy admiral. I'm a Democrat running for Congress. She looked at me and said, you're kidding me.
Right. What are you doing out here? Right.
Here's why I tell them, I say to it, is that, first of all, I wanted to work on health care, and I thought they were going to work on it more. But I actually said to them, look, I was an independent. But as I looked at the Navy, there was two things I saw. One of it is, in the military, a woman gets equal pay as a man the day she or he comes aboard. In the Navy, everybody gets health care, no questions asked, and their whole family. In the military, you can't rise, as when I got out of the Navy, above to be a senior chief petty officer unless you've earned at least an associate's college degree in education. And in a military officer, at least above a lieutenant commander or a master's degree. And then come on in and be trained for a lifetime in a skill. And then walk out, and you'll have a pension. And then I'd pause. And I'd say, everybody in the military is a Democrat. They just don't realize it. And then I'd stop. And then I'd stop, and I'd say, however, the Republicans also understand something at times much better than the Democrats. Now, I think, I was really talking about more of the Eisenhower, Reagan, probably Republicans, but I say they understand accountability. They understand that you've got to pay for it. They understand, as I'd like to tell my staff, think the unthinkable, fathom the unfathomable, but pay cash. In short, there's a sense of accountability that I felt the Republicans always brought. And I honestly believe today neither party has that, and that's why I say I'm running for it. But that was the primary reason, is I grew up in an environment where we gave health care to everybody, not because we were liberal or Democrat. We did it because we understood that we had a workforce, so to speak, a warrior force had to be ready to go. And as I told people when we were trying to work on the Affordable Care Act, look, I really believe in it because the Institute of Medicine says we lose in our economy somewhere between $100 to $140 billion a year of the under and uninsured. They cost us. And I also jokingly say that the second or third piece of legislation passed in 1789, when we had our very first Congress after we signed the Constitution up in New York, mandated the Affordable Care Act or Fair Huffit, the original Tea Partiers. And I love the Tea Party because they were running against the establishment like I was. But as I told them, your forefathers mandated that every sailor in the Merchant Marine had to have health care. And they had to pay for part of it because that's how come Ben Franklin began the first insurance company, one of the reasons, in Philadelphia, is because they did not want scurvy to ruin the merchant fleet, which was going to be the backbone of our economy, because it was going to take raw material from America to England and finished products back. So they mandated what you might call the Affordable Care Act, because they didn't want to, like the Institute of Medicine says, lose so much billions of dollars today in our economy because of the uninsured who get sick, go to the emergency room when they're really sick, costs us more. And that's why our forefathers did that. I try to show people that this is really not Democrat or Republican. It's kind of practical. And that's why I don't like to be too pigeonholed when people say you're progressive or social or this. But I have to tell you, I think when you sit down with people and explain facts like that, they just at least give you pause, like the woman did on immigration or the wall when I was in the parade.
Well, you know, first of all, Admiral, you just described, I have a brother that was in the military, and that was his life. He went in, he became a major, he was an F-111 pilot, just retired as president of a college. They put him through Vanderbilt to get a doctorate in education, all while he was in the Air Force. So that certainly was his experience. And again, let me just also say, before I forget this, I read in the article in National Review that you've been going into homeless shelters and getting people to work for you, and we talked about that for a minute. I want you to know, in my last campaign, I had 100 people at the polls. 50 of them were from a work program at a homeless shelter. We paid them $15 an hour. We fed them lunch. We gave them transportation. And I've never had better campaign workers ever. I won. They were so dedicated. They worked so hard. So you're right on the right track. But as we're starting to run out of time here, let me ask you a few pertinent questions, important questions. We've just seen this terrible tragedy in El Paso and in Dayton and also in California last week with these mass shootings. You're a military guy. You understand the importance of having a strong military and having weapons. What would you do as president? What can we do you think, to stem the tide of these horrible events where we have people walking into shopping centers with military style weapons? What could you do as president, do you think?
Well, one of the five things I want to do in my first 36 hours, and I won't mention the other four, but it'll take 36 hours to do them, is I'd first walk through a gun show. Because I want people to understand that I respect those Americans who rightfully want to have a gun, a second constitutional right. And then, like a captain of a ship going down the boiler, but boiler technicians, just to say, you're great guys down here. But then I would be very clear that, while, and I have pictures on my website where I'm there with assault weapons, because even as an admiral, I boarded contraband, ships with contraband, going up those 60, 70 feet, scaling rope ladders to climb up as we're being protected by assault weapons because I wanted to be out with the troops. But I don't want those assault weapons on the streets of Philadelphia or wherever, Washington, D.C. And then I'd say the Heller decision for Washington, D.C. was actually a good decision because it was written by a conservative Supreme Court justice who said you have the right to a gun, but much like you have freedom of speech and cannot go into a crowded movie theater and yell fire, that's not freedom of speech because it harms everyone. We also, he said, have to determine that this doesn't mean it's for everything. Now we've got to figure out what that is. I believe it's assault weapons. I believe it's right. In the Navy, expect what you inspect is what we learn. It's why our nuclear power out there has never had a problem, because we inspect it very well. And so we should have background checks that just make sure it's going to the right American, so to speak. I also believe that we should close the gun show loophole as well as the gun kit loophole. But I also believe this. I know that guns are particularly it's a public health issue. My wife is just completing a study for the VA on suicides, and the majority of suicides are by guns. So we need to study this issue, and to have the Center for Disease Control be forbidden to study it as a public health issue, guns, I think is wrong. I'm a Napoleon fan because he said, although I don't tell my wife this, if I were to be in love, I would analyze it bit by bit, because you can't ask how or why enough. I want to analyze, why is it that the women in the military commit suicide? Most of them use guns. And so it's a two thing here. But I have to tell you, when I was captain of a ship, I told anyone who owned a gun, you know, to bring it aboard, and I put it in the armory. And on Sunday afternoon, I'd stop the ship, and we didn't have flight ops. I mean, it was a small ship when I was captain, an FFG. We had helicopters, but I'd have Steel Beach picnic. Steel Beach, because that's what the deck's made of, steel. And we'd barbecue hot dogs. I had a wooden sled built that we kept it for each Sunday afternoon. We'd tow it almost Sunday afternoon and put a silhouette of a deer on it. And the men, at that time we only had men and combatants, we could take the guns out and practice away if what they wanted to. And I think that's what we have to get across. That's why I want to walk through there. I want to go to an NRA convention. I know Ollie North. Too bad he's not there anymore. He was the most impressive individual I met. He was president, as you know, of the NRA. But when I went down, he was back from Vietnam, and he was training us to see if we wanted to go Marine Corps. And if you didn't have your hair be a crew cut, I probably would have gone. I was so impressed. But I would have said, Mr. North, could you walk with me, Colonel? And, you know, we may disagree on it, but it's to show that, no, I respect you, but I also respect that we should have a level of inspection of who gets them. And also, we don't need weapons of war on our streets. And that's how I would approach it.
Well, I think that's
reasonable.
Right. It is. It's very reasonable. And again, I think this is a problem that we have as Democrats, that we don't want to just sit down and talk about it. We just want to resist. We talk down to people with guns. You know, we say you're just too dumb to realize you don't need a gun. Let us explain to you why you don't need it. Instead of saying that we do respect the Second Amendment, we just want to keep the guns out of the hands of crazy people, and we want to have appropriate weaponry. There really is no. I really can't see how anybody in a civilian capacity needs an AK-47 or an AR-15 rifle. I just don't get it. So I think that's a very reasonable approach. Let me ask you, since you were played such an important role in combating terrorism through the Navy's terrorism unit, how do you think we're doing? What do we need to do that we're not doing on that front? How would you rate our effort these days to combat terrorism worldwide?
I think three important points, if I could. First off, as far as our intelligence agencies and all are doing, I think they're doing an extraordinarily very good job, because this is really finding out how they're going to be out. But number two, I hope we learned a lesson about our military and terrorism. And by that I mean, I hope our next commander-in-chief understands, which senators, Democrat and Republican alike, did not understand, that militaries can stop a problem. They can never fix a problem. And so they voted for a tragic misadventure in Iraq that unleashed Sunni against Shia, Shia against Sunni, and created, with the help of the former General Saddam Hussein, ISIS, which, as it metastasized, took us to Syria beyond even the copycat killings in Los Angeles. And so what I try to point out to people is that militaries can stop a problem. They can't fix it. when I was on the ground, a very brief period, the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, head of the, you know, I was fugitive counterterrorism unit. When I came out, I said, and I say again the same today, if we fix the illiteracy rate of women in Afghanistan, which was about 98% when I was on the ground there, we would do more to fix the global war of terror than our military, after 19 years of war, has been courageously trying to stop it. We didn't fix Iraq with our military, but we did fix Iran with our power of our economy, the power of our diplomacy. We convened the world, including strange bedfellows like China and Russia, and removed their nuclear weapons-making capability from that country. And now we broke our word on a deal they kept, and we think our military is going to fix it. By the way, our carriers cannot survive in the Persian Gulf if we do a sustained strike, because we can't find their 19 mini submarines. Because our sonar doesn't work in shallow waters, it reverberates. That's my close to my third lesson. People better understand, if they want to use your military, how they better know how it will end before it begins. And somebody better know how it's going to end when we strike Iran, before it begins. So terrorism is truly, at the end of fixing the problem, is you've got to go to the real source, whether it's microloans or for women, which has been the best developmental aid in Afghanistan, or whether it is fixing the literacy rate. That's how you're eventually going to fix terrorism. Our military can stop it, but as you see, ISIS is now metastasized into Africa. This is an issue, much like fascism. Our military stopped Germany, but 2 years later, fascism was still alive in 47, and we only fixed it with the Marshall Plan that went in. That's why you need someone in the White House who understands all the elements of our power, not just military.
And I love that lesson that you just gave, because in my studies, I'm doing a female empowerment international dissertation, and they say that when you educate women, everybody improves in their society. Everybody.
Yes.
Not just the women, not just their children, but their spouses, their mates, their partners, and ultimately their society. So if you can start, again, talk about grassroots, if you can do what you just suggested, you do have a solution instead of a Band-Aid, if you will.
Maria, what you are studying and what you are proposing, two quick examples. I convened the world, I like to say, for 158 nations for the first Robotic Olympics at Constitution Hall right in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
Do you remember a few years ago the Afghanistan Muslim all-girls team that denied a visa to come to America for robotics?
Yes.
Yes,
I put
too.
That together. Yeah. And I purposely went to the Peace Institute in Washington, D.C., and I said, I always said if we educated, fix the literacy rate of women, we would do more to fix global war terror. I want an all-girls Muslim team to lead the procession to Constitution Hall. We got them all in, including the Afghan team. 60% of the teams, and I went to team, I raised $1.5 million. I had some other money given to me when I arrived to set this up, to get the poor people here, not just the rich schools. 60% of the teams were led by women, particularly from Africa, where my wife also has been doing work. And you know what? It was I finally said to women, why are you the leaders in this? There's women tech. There's STEM women all over the world. And it says, because we're the ones that are really responsible for raising our families. Let me take you to one more example, because that showed me the women with the power in that. 60% of those teams were led, organized by a woman. They made it happen. And some, they had 60 of the teams had never, ever, ever had taken a STEM education course, and these women made it happen. Last one, if I could. When I lost my race, I didn't want to take a lobbying job like 450 congressmen and senators have since 1998. So I went to teach Cheney University, Old Historical Black University, because they were my best demographics, the African-American community, when my party wouldn't let me come to wards in Philadelphia. Well, 200 congregations opened it up for me. I also, so I went back there, I went to Carnegie Mellon to teach, and I asked It was a research course. One was ethical leadership. The other was a research course. And I asked them, women, the incarceration rate of women in Pennsylvania is going up 80%. When they come out, what's the right recidivism program? Is it the same as men? Because I go to visit prisons every year for my vets on Veterans Day. Every year as a congressman and afterwards, except for last year when my daughter's brain cancer came back. So she found out that for women, the recidivism course should be different. For a guy, you appeal to his self-worth as an individual, basically his ego. For a woman, she gets value out of empowering and being part of a network of others. And I said to the woman who did the study, you have now answered to me why women in the military, when they've got into combatant ships in the Navy, in other words, we rated them higher than men, at least in their initial tours. Because you're given a division of 20 people, and you are asked to make them perform well. Where a guy comes in, and he has a lot of pride, and here it is, we're going to do this right, left, here. Those women form a team and empower it. It's exactly what you're saying. And that's why I love to have women in the military. They're better leaders, at least at the junior officer level.
Wow. That's so beautiful. I thank you so much. And Michael, can we just squeeze in one little question, because I'm so sensitive to this too, Admiral, about your views on climate change and what we can do about that? Because it's getting, they're throwing 2030 at us.
In both this administration under Jim Mattis and, as I said, in the previous administration, it really is an immediate threat to our national security. But I believe, as I tell everyone, that even if we were to pass the Green New Deal here at home and do that alone with its lofty goals, and let's say we do, I tell them it won't matter unless we convene the world. Because 85% of all the world's global greenhouse emissions come from overseas. And if we are to disarm that catastrophic bomb before it explodes on us, I tell them, we must convene the world. And that's one of the second two things I will do in my first 36 hours is go and reconvene the Paris Climate Accord, where 194 of the 196 nations aren't even coming close to meeting the inadequate commitments already done. And I'd raise them, try to, and enforce them. Saudi Arabia will use as much energy to power its air conditioning one decade from now as it exports in oil today. 8% of the tropics has air conditioning today. 50% will have it in 2050. It will be, has as much air conditioning, electrical use for that, will be equal to what we've had from 1902 to 2005 beyond there. And if we don't sign up to the Kigali Agreement and enforce the most efficient standards of air conditioning in the world, if we do, it'll be equivalent to reforesting two-thirds of the Amazon. So my answer to you is, do I believe in it? Darn right I do. But unless you have someone in that White House with the breadth and depth of global experience and understand that it's about convening the world, we can't achieve it. And that's why the sculpture, as you probably know, that's closest to the Oval Office is not of an American. It's of a foreigner. The man, the general of an ally who stood beside George Washington to win the Battle of Yorktown, even commanding American troops. And so his sculpture is closest to the Oval Office to remind the president, not that that man should be honored, the sculpture, but that General Rauschenbaugh is a reminder that we won our freedom, our American dream, only because of an ally. And if we don't continue to restore U.S., if we don't stop this retreat from the world, and we don't restore our leadership in this world, as John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan and others understood in this global concord that we built after World War II, there is no way we can protect our American dream here at home. And to me, that's the second major reason I'm running. Yes, accountability. Second, understand it's one world now. Whether it's the rise of an illiberal China, or whether it is saving us from climate change, we must restore U.S. leadership in the world in a way that respects and values allies and friends.
Well, that's a great way to end, Admiral. I'm sorry we're out of time. I have to ask you this question. I think I know the answer to it. Just give me a yes or no, please. DC statehood, do you support it?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. How do you support it?
God bless you for that. And thanks
I'm a politician.
For being on our show.
JoeSestak.com is the website.
Yes,
JoeSestak.com. And I'd appreciate, and I do appreciate you bringing that up, because we're living in Iowa. We've got good buzz here. Came back from Wall Street Journal for an editorial board. But I've got to get a dollar from 130,000 people, $1 from each of 130,000 people to make that debate stage. So thank you all very much for bringing up.
You can count on us.
Yes, you can count on us. And we will keep your daughter in our prayers. What's her name, Admiral?
Her name is Alex. And as she said, when I told her I didn't know what I was going to do after my last loss, except maybe be a Walmart greeter, and you'll appreciate this because of my answer, she said, "Oh, Daddy, nobody will ever get into Walmart then."
Well, there you go. There you go. And I've had the same reaction from my kids. Well, we wish the best for Alex. We'll keep her in our prayers. We'll keep you in our prayers. And I've got to tell you, I agree with the Des Moines Register. You impress with your experience and your smarts. So go get them, Admiral. Yes. I hope you come back, because we have a lot more to talk about. I hope you come back as the campaign progresses. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, sir. And I hope to welcome you into the real Senate someday. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And we're going to leave you tonight with the only song that I could think of to leave you with. Usually we honor our guests, but this is actually in with our condolences to all those survivors and the people that lost people in El Paso and Dayton and California in the last few weeks. This is from the Youngbloods. The song is called Darkness, Darkness. And we'll see you next week. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening.
Yes.
Give the people their right to vote.